Welcome to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. Very pleased. This is Dr. Michael McGee here, and very pleased and honored to have Dr. Alan Berger from California with us today to talk about emotional sobriety. Welcome, Dr. Berger.
Well, thank you, Michael. Listen, first of all, let me congratulate you on your show.
Oh, thank you.
I understand the first show that you're doing, and I'd love to just hear a little bit about it. What are your hopes for this show?
Well, I guess the hopes are to do all things wellness and with a large focus on recovery from trauma and from addiction, and optimizing our human potential, making
wow.
the best of this gift of this life that we each have to live.
Well, that's fantastic. And boy, as we talk today, I think you're going to see how well emotional sobriety fits in to the goals you have for this show.
Great. Well, thank you for joining me today. It's really great to have you. Do you want to tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Well, yes, I would. Thank you. So I came into the field right after I came into my recovery right after I came back from Vietnam in 1971. I went into Marine Corps when I was 17 years old, and I was in Vietnam when I was 18. I went into the Marine Corps with an alcohol problem, and I came back from Vietnam with a problem with alcohol and other drugs. So I was very fortunate, Michael. I was the third Marine admitted into a program that was designed to help Vietnam vets that were returning with drug problems rather than discharge them back to their communities. Up to that point in time, the Marine Corps had a zero tolerance for drug problems. So if you were a Marine with a drug problem, it was you were discharged and, bye-bye, hasta la vega, baby. And so I just happened, this is one of those miracles, right? Serendipity or synchronicity, whichever way you want to think about it, where I ended up going into this program and they had no idea what they were doing. I was a third Marine admitted to the program, but they knew they didn't know. And so they turned to the 12-step community and they sent some young people that were in recovery, this one fellow by the name of Tom McCall, and he doesn't mind me breaking his anonymity. He came to the Marine Corps base, and he shared his story with us. Mm. And that began my journey, and that was in the summer of 1971. So
wow.
Currently I have 47 years in recovery, and, one day at a time this summer I'll be celebrating 48 years.
Congratulations.
And, part of what happened when I heard Tom share his story, and this is really relevant to this whole topic today of emotional sobriety, is it was the first time I saw a person who was free from themselves. I mean, he talked about himself with a freedom that I had never experienced before. The only time that I was that free from myself is when I was either high or drunk. And he talked about his insecurities, his fears, his inadequacies, his feeling stupid, all of these things. And he was willing to be vulnerable and own these things. And I thought I was going to keep those things a secret the rest of my life. I didn't dare let anybody know I had any of those feelings. And here was a man, owning those and standing there and being vulnerable and okay with it. I mean, that was a mind blower for me. And look, what I realized today when I look back, Michael, that was the freedom I was always looking for.
Yeah.
That's the freedom I got when I was drinking or using.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
That started my journey. I got turned on to recovery, and then they didn't have many counselors, so after I had about 2 months clean and sober, they asked me to come on board as a counselor, and then I got turned on to working with people. And then I decided at that point in time that, even though I was a high school dropout with a GED, that I wanted to go back to school and get a degree in clinical psychology. And so that was the tripod, if you will, that my recovery was based on, being excited about working with other people, being excited about recovery, and then getting excited about education and really trying to learn how I could you know, make a difference in people's lives.
You are a living example of the miracle of recovery.
Well, thank you. I feel that, and I'm very, very grateful for it. I don't take that for granted in any way. It really is, you know, something that I appreciate on a daily basis.
You know, before we get into the emotional sobriety topic, I just also want to note that you are an incredibly gifted author who writes in a really deeply insightful, but also very easy to read way about addiction and recovery. And I was wondering if you wouldn't mind telling the audience a little bit about your book.
Yeah. My first book that I wrote about recovery was 12 Stupid Things That Mess Up Recovery. And that kind of grew out of my own experiences and the struggles I had. And I thought, boy, it'd be nice to put something together to share some of the things I had been learning along the way. And that book became very, and it continues to be very popular. I think it's close to selling over 100,000 copies at this particular point in time.
Congratulations.
So that book has done well. And in that book, I started to introduce this discussion of emotional sobriety. In my second book, then, 12 Smart Things to Do When the Booze and Drugs Are Gone, was really a focus on what is emotional sobriety and how can we achieve it in our lives. And that book has gotten some really great traction. It's doing quite well. And then the third book I wrote was really looking at the therapeutic forces involved in the 12 steps. You know, as you know, being a psychiatrist and a mental health professional, there's quite a schism between the mental health professionals and the recovery community. And because, you know, in the 12 steps we use the word God, that doesn't sit well with a lot of mental health professionals. Now, they don't understand that we say God as you understand them. It's not a religious program. It's a spiritual program. But you have to be open to getting past the word God to hear that. So I wanted to put a book out there that would help mental health professionals, as well as some other people in the program that maybe had religious abuse or something like that, but another way of looking at the steps and the incredible power that they've really harnessed in terms of solid psychological forces that create change. And, you know, you and I have, you know, been in firsthand being able to witness what happens to people's lives when they really work the steps and commit themselves to, you know, practicing those principles in their daily affairs. So that book was The 12 Hidden Rewards of Making Amends. So it was talking about the therapeutic value. My most recent book is 12 More Stupid Things That Mess Up Recovery, where I continue the discussion of emotional sobriety and look at some different aspects of it. So this point, those are the books I've written. I mean, there's one in the pipeline coming up. It's going to be the 12 Core Concepts of Emotional Sobriety. So something that's going to be focused specifically on that. And then I hope to write a book for the general public called Life on Life's Terms, which is capturing the heart of emotional sobriety, isn't it?
Oh, that's great. Very prolific and really a gift to the world.
Thank you, Michael. And I think a lot of wonderful things about the book that you've just come out with, too, The Joy of Recovery, which I've really enjoyed reading.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Tell us about emotional sobriety. What is emotional sobriety?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, let me first kind of frame it in terms of this whole recovery and 12-step recovery. Bill Wilson's really the first person that coined that phrase. And the first place he's written about it was actually in the 12 and 12, which was probably written in 1950 and published in 52. And there, in step 12, when he's starting to introduce step 12, he says in the last paragraph that if we practice these principles in our daily affairs, then we and those about us achieve emotional sobriety. So I didn't even come across that until about 10 years ago. It's amazing how many times I read the 12 and 12, and that never registered in the way it registers to me today. So what he's saying is that the program is really directed at helping people find this personal freedom. And that's what emotional sobriety is about not being controlled by, well, the way I say it, well, let me read my definition to you. I pulled it up here because I knew we'd be talking about it today. This is the way I've defined it recently. I say emotional sobriety is when the best in you does the thinking and talking for all of you. I'll say that again. It's when the best in you does the thinking and talking for all of you. And I say that this state of mind is achieved when what you do becomes a determining force in your emotional well-being. Rather than allowing your emotional well-being to be overly influenced by external events or by what other people are or are not doing. So a good way to think about it is if we think about an emotional center of gravity, and I love to use this analogy because I think it's really powerful. It was actually first discussed by a Dr. Karen Horney. She says we all have an emotional center of gravity, and she said it's akin to your physical center of gravity. So when your physical center of gravity is over your 2 feet and you're equally balanced over your feet, you're in a very, very solid place. And, you know, if you bend your knees and sink down into it, now you're in a strong athletic stance. And if you go a little deeper, you're in what the people, the karate practitioner calls the horse stance, which in Korean was translated into the immovable stance. Because you're so well grounded, you're going to not be easily knocked off balance. Mm-hmm. Now, we have an emotional center of gravity very similar. If we're well grounded in ourselves and over our true self, then we're not going to be knocked off balance by life. We're going to be able to absorb whatever blows come our way. We're going to be able to deal with life on life's terms. We're going to be able to handle things regardless of what they are. But if my emotional center of gravity is dependent on what other people are doing or dependent on things going my way, now you see where my trouble begins. Now it's easy to get knocked off balance. So if I'm dependent on you talking to me a certain way during this radio show, well, I can even give a better example than that. So I did a webinar for Hazelton the other day, a new twist on emotional, on motivational interviewing, right? Activating the healthy self in our patients. And while he's doing the show, I mean, it's going, the webinar's going great, and I'm showing some videos, and I'm trying to narrate them as we go. So I'm pausing the video and then talking. Well, what they didn't realize is that when I paused it on my end, it wasn't pausing it on a lot of other people's browsers. So a lot of the audience, there was over 500 people listening to the webinar, are hearing my voice and the video at the same time and getting quite frustrated.
Oh, dear.
And finally, you know, the person who's doing the webinar gets my attention, and now I need to deal with that situation. Well, instead of getting knocked off balance, I say, okay, instead of getting hung up, well, wow, this shouldn't have happened, and we should have anticipated this, or they should have, and getting into blaming and stuff like that, I said, wow, I'm just become aware that we've got a problem. I want to apologize to you for it. Let me go ahead and play the video, and I'm not going to say a word. And then afterwards, if there's some time, I'll make a few comments. So I had to deal with it because it is what it is, right? Life is what it is. It's how we cope with it that counts. And so that's an example of it. If my emotional center of gravity is, this has to be perfect and it's got to go this way or that way, mm-hmm. boy, I would have been knocked off balance. I wouldn't known what to do. We would have hung up. I would have got on the phone, either blamed myself or blamed them, and I would have made a bad situation worse.
Right, right.
And,
you know there's so much, Alan, in what you're saying. When I think of sobriety, I think of being addiction free or free from addiction, and the addiction would be to an addiction to things needing to be a certain way or needing to get perhaps approval or good things coming back to you from other people in order to feel good and grounded. And what you're saying in this, and you use the word freedom, is a sense of being grounded and having a sense of equanimity and a relative sense of peace that is regardless of circumstances. Is that right?
Yeah, right on. You've really captured the essence of it. That's exactly what emotional sobriety is about.
The other thing that uses the word true self, and I'm reminded of the definition for spiritual intelligence, which is very similar. And spiritual intelligence is defined as the ability to act with compassion and wisdom,
yeah,
with internal and external peace, under regardless of circumstances.
See, that's that person keeping that emotional center of gravity, right, over their own 2 feet.
Yeah, and you also mentioned the true self. And I don't know if you've thought about this, but there's also the idea of the higher self that lives and acts out of a force of love,
mm-hmm,
versus the ego self, which is living and acting out of a sense of fear or need or, security concerns. Does that fit with what you're...
It fits very much. The way I think about it, too, just to elaborate a little bit more on it, is that, our true self means that we become a fully functioning human being, which means that I am able to deal with what I'm experiencing. My feelings are not something that I avoid, that I don't know how to deal with, that I shy away from discomfort. I take life as it comes to me, and I'm able to digest it. The example I use a lot for good, healthy functioning is our digestive system. It's an amazing thing, which you could probably tell me more about than I can say right now. But it's, I take an apple. Let's say I'm hungry, and I take a bite of an apple, and I start chewing it up. Well, as I chew it, I start adding, right, my saliva, I add certain enzymes to it and stuff like that. I put it in my stomach. I start digesting it. My stomach twists, adds more acid and stuff, breaks it down, goes into my GI, into my intestinal tract, and I start extracting from it what my body needs, and then I eliminate the stuff that I don't. And so pretty soon, what started out as an apple at some point becomes me. You can't say that this is inside Alan is an apple anymore. It's not. It's now a part of Alan, and the parts that aren't going to nourish me or grow me, I let go of. I eliminate, right? I urinate or I defecate.
Sure.
And that's healthy functioning. So I take whatever experience comes in my life, no matter what it is, and I digest it to the point where I take from that experience what will grow me, and I let go of the rest. But you see that all these ideas of who we should be and how things should be and how life should be interferes with that organismic wisdom.
Yes. When we're making judgments and preconceptions about how reality, quote-unquote, should be, then we really block ourselves off from being able to openly embrace our experience without judgment.
And, the funny thing about that is that when people do the research about it, is there an addictive personality and stuff like that? Well, the truth is they don't find it. An introvert can become an addict as well as an extrovert. It doesn't matter. What the thing that distinguishes us from other people, and I don't think it distinguishes us as much as people say or differentiates us, is the fact that we don't learn from our experience. And what I've seen is that I think, in general, people have a hard time learning from their experience because it means being willing to deal with what is instead of imposing, like you said, all these preconceived notions, ideas on how things should be for me to be okay.
Right. And that requires a real receptive openness to experience and, in some way, valuing all experience, whether it's pleasurable or painful.
That's right. When a patient comes to me and says, I'm interested in working with you, I just want to be, I want a lot more happiness in my life. And I say, look, I'm all for that too, and I'd like to help you with that, but I'm more interested in helping you become alive. Because if you're alive, you're going to experience your happiness when you have it, and you're going to also experience your sadness or disappointment. And you're going to be able to move between those experiences. But see, in our society, we want to control so much, don't we, Michael? That we just want to be happy all the time. I just want more happiness. That's going to make me okay. Well, no, that's not going to make you okay. That's going to make you addicted to happiness, just like you said a minute ago.
Yes. Life involves a lot of pain and suffering. I've heard it said that the near side of love is pain, that, you know, if you try and shut down and avoid distress and pain in life, you're basically shutting yourself to all of life, and that just
right.
completely numbs you and deadens you to the world and to yourself.
No, that's very, very true what you're saying. That is it. So, you know, that this emotional sobriety is about being able to show up for yourself in your life and be able to meet whatever situation is going on in a way where you walk away from it being whole.
That's beautiful. Well, we should, after the break, we should talk about how we cultivate emotional sobriety. Hello, this is Dr. Mike with Dr. Alan Berger. Our guest today, talking about emotional sobriety. Alan, you said that emotional sobriety is that capacity to live and act and from your higher self, from your true self, from your best self, you said, in the service of what is best for you, regardless of what you might be happening. I'm wondering if and then you also said that that really that capacity is born by the ability to honor all experience, whether pleasurable or painful, and to digest and learn from our experiences, and perhaps even the painful experiences of life are the greatest teachers of all, and to honor pain and distress as teachers, and to be open to all of life and to metabolize in all of life. So that we can learn and grow and experience the fullness of life. And I'm just wondering, how did you come up with, you came up with the term emotional sobriety from first when you first read that from Bill Wilson in 12 and 12, is that right?
Yes. He, in 12 and 12, actually, the first exposure I had to it, and I, for many, many years, I mistakenly said that the first time Bill Wilson mentioned emotional sobriety was in this 1956 letter that ended up being published in 1958 in the Grapevine, the AA Grapevine. But I was wrong about that. It really was in the 12 and 12. So Bill wrote this letter in 56 to someone out here in California that was depressed. And his fellow wrote to the General Service Office and says, listen, can someone help me? I'm trying to apply these steps to my depression, and does anybody have any experience with that? Well, you know, you and I know the story. Bill struggled with his depression throughout his recovery. And, you know, he was a seeker, you know. He really was on a quest to try to figure things out and had some great spiritual direction from some great spiritual leaders in the country at that time, and he had some great help from a Harry Tebow, the first psychiatrist that befriended Alcoholics Anonymous. I often say they had an informal psychotherapeutic relationship because I imagine they had some very, 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 and I am aware of some of those, but they had some very, very important talks through the years. So Bill, in this letter, shared with this gentleman all the things that he had learned about his emotional sobriety. And, you know, as we're taking a break, you talk about, well, how do we achieve this state of mind, right?
Yeah.
You know, how do we get to that place? Well, I'll tell you, the first thing that Bill talked about, and this is true in psychotherapy as well, he had to become aware of what was blocking him from being able to function better in his life. And what he got in touch with was what he called the claims that he made on other people. And these claims showed up in the form of demands, that he demanded the possession and control of the people and the places surrounding him, thinking that if everybody does everything the way I want them to, I'm going to be okay.
Right.
And see, that's the first step in terms of getting freedom, is to realize how controlled we are by these rules. I call these unenforceable rules that we impose on life, that we impose on other people, that we impose on events or conditions in our life. And Bill had to sit down and get honest with himself and see that a big source of his depression is when things didn't go the way he wanted them to. He would fight for them, and that's one response to this, what we'll call emotional dependency. And when he couldn't get other people to bend to his will, then he just became deflated.
Yes.
And that deflation he experienced his depression.
Yes, yes, because he was dependent upon other people acting or saying or doing things the way that he expected and wanted them to be done. And when people didn't respond to his will, he felt defeated and depressed.
Just like he was dependent on alcohol to make him feel better.
Exactly.
Right? To make him feel more connected, to make him feel more whole. So, see, you start to see that there's a pattern there. And so the first step that he took to try to free himself from this is to realize that, my God, I don't have a right to impose my expectations on other people. They're their own person. What do you say? We step on the toes of others and they retaliate. Of course, nobody wants to be controlled.
Right.
In these, you know, in life. So what Bill started to get in touch with is that he had to unhook these, what he called, deadly expectations on that people should do the things that, he wanted them to do for him to be all right. And instead he focused on what he needed to do to be okay, on how he needed to deal with life on life's terms. And that was the path that he took to start to free himself from his emotional dependency and start to actually have some freedom, what he called a nice, serene place in the bright sunshine of life, or something like that is the phrase that he used. But what he was really talking about is that now he wasn't going through life and putting these expectations, or if he did, he caught them, and this is where step 10 comes in, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it, he would catch them and unhook his expectations on other people and get himself centered again. So it's a very powerful lesson he shared with us. And look, in psychotherapy, it's the same thing. I really strive to help people become aware of what they're doing, because you can't change what's going on until you see what you're actually doing. And a lot of us are totally unaware of how we put these expectations and demands on other people.
So a lot of your work with people, and what you're saying is that one of the first steps to liberating ourselves from emotional dependency is to develop awareness and insight into the ways which we unconsciously and maybe even automatically put out expectations and attempt to control the way people behave in order to meet our needs.
That's right. That's exactly right. You know, a brilliant, brilliant psychiatrist was Dr. Alexander Lowen. He was the father of bioenergetics therapy. He translated a lot of Wilhelm Reich's work. Reich was one of the disciples of Freud, who was the first one to really look at the body and how body deals with trauma. And he had a brilliant hypothesis. He says that when, let me see if I can capture the whole thing, is that when we have an experience in our childhood that either threatens our self-acceptance or our sense of security, right? So some kind of trauma that interferes with our self-acceptance and our sense of security, that we are going to require the future to reverse the experiences of the past.
Mm. Yes.
And
that repetition was, compulsion to try and,
that's
and,
right.
and have the
that's,
future undo the trauma of the
undo
past.
The, and what happens, you said unconsciously, then I have all these rules about what's supposed to happen. So if I wasn't listened to in my childhood, what I'm going to demand you to do if we're in a relationship is to listen to me all the time.
Right.
And I'm going to say that, God, if you love me, you listen to me. I had a client sit in my office today, and he was demanding that his wife see him. And that's because he wasn't seen. But see, I don't free myself by getting other people to see me. I have to see what I'm doing to free myself. Yeah. And that's where freedom starts.
Yeah. It's really a renunciation of depending on other people to.
That's a great way to say it.
To help us feel secure and safe and valued in the world. Okay, just a reminder, this is Dr. Michael McGee, the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show, and we're privileged today to have Dr. Alan Berger with us here today talking about emotional sobriety, and we'll be right back with you after this break. Okay, we're back. This is Dr. Michael McGee with the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show with Dr. Alan Berger talking about emotional sobriety. And we've been talking about ways to cultivate our emotional sobriety, our freedom from being emotionally dependent upon other people for our well-being, and talking about becoming aware of and insightful of the ways that we perhaps unconsciously or even consciously put expectations on other people to behave in certain ways for us to feel safe and secure and valued and loved. And Dr. Berger, thank you for being here. I wonder if you tell us a little bit more about how people can begin to be more mindful and more aware of the ways that they're unconsciously placing demands and expectations on others.
Well, that's, I think, a very important thing. Bill Wilson said, I think, when he was writing the 12 and 12, in when he was talking about step 10, which is that continue to take personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. He said, it's a spiritual axiom that every time I'm disturbed, no matter the cause, there's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
So it's a really good kind of centering thought. Is say, if I'm upset, instead of looking at what everybody else is doing, you know, what I encourage people to do in my second book, 12 Smart Things to Do When the Booze and Drugs Are Gone, I propose a way that people can do that. In fact, people can go onto my website, which is www.abphd.com. That's abphd.com, and they can download a form called the Emotional Sobriety Inventory. So what I, on the form, it is, hey, what is the situation that upset you? And then I get people to start to unpack their expectations and their dependency with this form. And there's some great examples of how to do that in the book. But let me give you a personal example of this, I think, as a way to illustrate this to our audience. About 6 years ago now, my wife and I were pregnant. She was a grad student at UCLA at cancer biology. She was doing her postdoc, so we were going to have the child through the UCLA midwife group. So part of that, UCLA has a lot of money in doing genetic research and trying to anticipate any difficulties that, you know, new parents might have, is they did a bunch of genetic testing and they took a bunch of her blood. And so we get through the first trimester, there's no problem, and we hear nothing back about the testing they did on her, so we think everything's fine. And then one day, we left the visit, and I'm driving down to my office in Hermosa Beach. She's up in Los Angeles at UCLA, and all of a sudden, she's walking over to her lab, and she gets a call. And the midwife says, oh, I forgot to go over something with you. You need to come back. Well, she goes back, and it turns out that she tested positive for a gene, and that if I had this same gene, our daughter would have a 25% chance of being born with what they call spinal muscular atrophy. And the effect of this, in the worst, the most severe case, is that the child would live for a year and a half.
Mm.
Best case, Michael, she'd live till she was 14. Now, you can, I don't need to explain how upset she got when she heard this. So she calls me, she's crying, she's having a, she's, you know, having a panic attack, and I rush back to the hospital, and I'm crying, and she's crying, they have to take my blood, and we've got now about a 6 week window before they're going to get back the results of my tests. So we're looking at living in this limbo for a long time, and we were besides ourselves. I was upset. She was upset. We're catastrophizing. We're awfulizing all of these terrible things about what's going to happen. And, you know, as they say, the smarter you are, the more that you can create incredible catastrophes in terms of projections into the future. So you got two PhDs sitting there just driving each other nuts. And, you know, we reached out. I reached out to my sponsor friends. She did as well. And everybody was very compassionate and understanding, but it didn't take away the incredible anxiety we were feeling.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which is what you were naturally supposed to be feeling.
Exactly, in that situation. But I kept saying to myself, because I got this emotional sobriety stuff in my head, what can I do to get centered again? What's happening that I'm so off balance? That's another way of thinking about emotional sobriety. Like you said, it's keeping equanimity, keeping balance, and keeping yourself balanced. And I was off balance. So we tried to go to sleep that night, and, you know, neither one of us slept. It was very, very fitful sleep, no rest at all. But then the morning I woke up, and it hit me. I got it. What I was doing was I was putting my emotional center of gravity in that things had to be a certain way for me to be okay. And I said to myself, I said, what am I letting these circumstances determine how I'm going to be? If God gives me our unborn child, whose name was going to be Madeline, if I get Madeline for a year and a half, I'm going to love her a lifetime in a year and a half. If I'm so lucky to have her, if that's what turns out to be the case, and I have her for 14 years, then I'll love her a lifetime in 14 years. And I'll do my best to enjoy every moment with her.
Right.
As soon as I thought that thought and had that concept, all the anxiety was gone. I felt none of it. I was grounded again. When I shared it with my wife, she was grounded. It's like we took Xanax.
Wow.
There was
wow.
no anxiety left. Then I had the second thought that even gave me more peace of mind, which is Maddie wouldn't know the difference.
Right.
Her life will be what her life is. I know the difference because of the life I've had, but we can make her life the best it can be because it'll be her life.
Right.
And those two things got me so much in touch with the fact that I had this expectation that I should have a child born the way I think that child should be born.
Right.
Once again, that was an unconscious expectation. If you would have told me going into it, you've got some expectations behind all of this stuff, I would have said, no, I don't. But I sure discovered it in terms of my reaction to that situation.
Yeah.
And so that's an example of how we can deal with whatever is going to happen to our life. And just a real quick, I just want to say this because it's amazing. Many, many years ago, I came across a book that Dr. Viktor Frankl wrote called Man's Search for Meaning.
Yeah.
And the first half of his book is all about his experience in the concentration camp.
Right.
And what he discovered there is the exact same thing Bill Wilson talked about and that I experienced with dealing with Maddie. He said that our job, and this is, he's talking about being with other members or other people that were in the concentration, our job was to learn ourselves and then teach the other men that it did not matter what we expected from life. Rather, our job was to deal with what life expected from us and to see ourselves as now tasked with dealing with life on life's terms rather than flipping it around. And he said, when people got that, then even in the concentration camp, they could thrive emotionally and develop more maturity.
And I think he also wrote about us having the freedom to ultimately determine how it is that we respond to us.
Right, he talked about that there's a space between the stimulus and the response.
Right.
And he says, live in that space. And that space is where you have the ability to choose.
Yeah. When we come back, we're going to be taking a break here. This is Dr. Michael McGee, Well Mind with Dr. Mike, with Dr. Alan Berger talking about emotional sobriety. And we'll be taking a break here shortly, but when we come back, it would be great to talk about the spiritual aspects of a reverent acceptance for things exactly as they are, which I think underlies some of what you're talking about, Ellen. Welcome back. Dr. Michael McGee here with Well Mind with Dr. Mike. We're very fortunate today to have Dr. Alan Berger with us and talking about his development of a treatment approach to recovery involving emotional sobriety. And we've been talking about the story of his child, his unborn child, and coming to a place of of deep acceptance and unconditional acceptance of her, however she would be when she was born. And by the way, Bayan, how did the pregnancy turn out?
Well, it turned out that I didn't, you know, I did not have that gene. So now the chances went from a 1 out of 4 chance of her having that condition to a 1 out of 1,000 or more.
Oh, okay.
So we were very fortunate that, you know, that we didn't cross that bridge. But like I said, it was, we got to the place where we were totally in acceptance that if that's what we had to do, we were going to do it. And we were going to do it in the best way
now?
We could do it. You know, and that's what you were saying. It's about that acceptance.
Yes, yes. You know, I think acceptance, there's a spiritual component, maybe. I wonder if you hear your words about that. But.
Well, I think you and I both could talk about that, that, boy, every spiritual practice really comes around to dealing with life as life is.
Yes.
I mean, you know, people, I've heard it said that reality is only reality 100% of the time. So it's kind of that. Yeah, it's so funny. When I was in at school at Cal State Long Beach working on my undergraduate degree, I was in the bathroom once, and I knew an addict wrote this on the wall because he says, reality is for people who can't handle drugs. Was really turning around the whole issue, but really the opposite was really true, right? I didn't know how to handle reality, so I'd rather live in the fantasy world that I created by getting high.
Right.
So, you know, this accepting life on life's terms, mm-hmm. you know, we talk about that all the time in recovery. Acceptance is the key.
Yes.
To really establishing a solid foundation in our recovery. And it takes a lot of work. That sounds passive, but there's nothing passive to it at all. It takes an awful lot of work to let go of all these ideas about how things should be to be able to deal with life on life's terms.
Yeah.
And that's what maturity is, right? That's what it means to grow yourself in this direction. And, you know, as we know, is when we start drinking or using, what happens to our maturity? It gets arrested.
That's right.
We don't grow up. So, you know, we talk right. about the king baby or the queen baby in the program. And I'm, you know, a king baby, and I've seen a lot of king and queen babies in the program. And there is nothing like the 12-step journey in recovery that is focused on that to help people grow themselves. I think of you know, the work we do is people growing work. And helping
Absolutely.
People find some new possibilities in life in terms of how to deal with their problems and how to deal with themselves and how to deal with other people. And, boy, this emotional sobriety fits right into that, Michael.
Yes, it does. You know, when I think about acceptance, I also think about the term appreciation. And spiritually, the idea that we have this gift of consciousness and the sense that spiritually that this moment, this reality, is profoundly sacred, unconditionally sacred.
Mm.
And
oh, I like
can
how you
we appreciate,
that
even
great.
In the middle of pain, can we appreciate the sacredness of this moment, even as we're, say, worrying about whether Madeline is going to have this gene or not?
Right. Right on. That's nice. I like the word, too. You used the word, I think, on one of our breaks, was radical acceptance.
Yes. Or I would say even, how about this, radical reverence.
Ooh, even better.
that really, in my work with patients, I teach this idea that, that this reality, if it is sacred, that really our spiritual practice, whether we're atheists or theists or anything in between, our spiritual practice is really to have a worshipful, reverent relationship with the now, with this present moment.
Yeah.
Even when it's very painful.
I like that. I really like that. Yeah, right on. That's a great way to say it. Yeah.
And I wonder about humility, because I think that you know, to really have a reverence for reality and to worship reality is really a great act of humility, I think. I don't know. Do you work around humility?
That humility is the cornerstone of this emotional sobriety, because it means that I don't have a right to impose my expectations on life or on other people.
Right.
You know, and And so it starts with really being able to accept that. And I'll tell you, when I talk to couples, a lot of times is, you know, where this shows up when people are in trouble in their relationships and they have all these rules on how their partner's supposed to behave for them to feel okay. And when I'm starting to talk like this, and, you know, so many people think, well, their rules are righteous.
Right.
I have a right to demand this in a relationship.
Right.
Like this one guy saying, you know, God, you know what? Well, you know, I don't. You think I have a right to say to my wife, I want to have sex, and what's wrong that you don't want to have sex with me?
Right.
I say, yeah, you have a right to ask for anything you want, but if you talk to her about it that way and turn it into a demand, I'm sure that's not going to get her very turned on to wanting to have sex with you. I mean, now it becomes a demand.
Yeah.
Instead
right.
of saying, you know, I love you, I'm interested in enjoying some time with you. Do you have any interest? So, see, that's the other thing, is that by letting go of these things, now I can start to move towards what Martin Buber called the I-to-thou relationship.
Right.
And that really, really becomes, to me, the paradigm of a healthy relationship. You know, next week you and I are going to be doing some presentations at the Evolution of Addiction Treatment Conference, which I'm really excited about. But at the end of April of this year, April 26th, 27th, and 28th, I'm going to be doing a weekend retreat called Emotional Sobriety, the Gateway to Healthy Relationships. And in that weekend, we're really going to be exploring this I-to-thou relationship and what it means. And, you know, just a quick preview of that is that an I-to-thou relationship is where you are as important as I am. I'm no more important than you, and I'm no less important than you. And so we move into that space where I'm meeting you, and I'm not bringing any expectations in terms of who you're supposed to be. I'm experiencing you as you are, and you're experiencing me as I am. And that kind of relationship is based on, I want you to do what you want to do. I don't want you to do what I want you to do. And when that becomes the foundation for a relationship, then people start to learn how to cooperate with integrity instead of cooperating, or what I call compromising, and losing yourself. And that's the hallmark of a healthy relationship, is learning how to cooperate with your partner but not compromising your integrity.
Right, right. But both people making a mutual commitment to the principle of integrity for the relationship to be healthy.
Yes, that's right. Exactly.
And there's a sense of a reverent respect for the autonomy of each person, and a generous wishing for their well-being in what you're saying. It's beautiful. How can people, tell us again, when's the conference and where is it, and how can people find out?
Well, the Evolution Conference you and I are speaking at is at the Sheraton LAX next week, and there's still registrations being taken. You're
how about
going to
give your emotional
keynote
variety?
Presentation, I am, and then the weekend retreat I'm doing is at Hazleton at the Dan Anderson Renewal Center. So if you go online and just say Dan Anderson Renewal Center, Alan Berger Retreat, you should be able to get to that page. But you can also find that on my website. My website is www.abphd.com. And so there's an event section there, and it's going to be posted there with registration instructions.
Oh, this is great. Very, very exciting. I hope as many people as possible in the audience can come to that, because it sounds like a wonderful way to revolutionize and revitalize relationships and really do some practical work about realizing emotional sobriety in people's lives.
Yes.
Well, this has been great. Great to have you, Dr. Berger, Dr. Alan Berger, on the show with WellMind with Dr. Mike. And really appreciate so much your joining us and sharing your wisdom with everyone.
Well, thank you, Dr. Mike, and I consider it an honor to be your first guest, and hopefully I can come back on at some point in time.
Yes, let's do that again.
If you need a place for you or someone you love to help get you through the recovery process, then check out thehaven.com. Committed to integrity and excellence, they use evidence-based effective treatment that is patient-centered and patient-responsive. a total mind, body, spirit program in a safe, serene setting on the Central California coast. Visit thehaven.com. You'll be glad you did. That's thehaven.com.
Information, entertainment, worldwide. HealthyLife.net.
Get ready to be addiction-free. This number one best-selling multi-award-winning guide is what you've been waiting for. With his book, Joy of Recovery, the Harvard-trained Dr. Michael McGee has helped hundreds of patients to full recovery. Imagine transforming your life with the Joy of Recovery's unique 12-step program. Take the first step to overcome your obstacles now by getting the Joy of Recovery. Available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or drmichaelmcgee.com.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
Well Mind is where you'll get all the information you need to get personal consultations and help from Dr. Michael McGee. Using integrated methods for the mind, body, spirit, you'll get consistent and compassionate care. Whether you are a patient, caregiver, or a professional, Dr. McGee has a program for you. Sessions can be in person or by computer from anywhere in the world. Visit wellmind.com to see how Dr. McGee can help you. That's wellmind.com.